you make that sound like it's an easy question. Like, this is the starter question, but it's actually very hard.
So that's a good question. I think free will is
I think is
what free will is actually a pretty complicated question.
So what is free will?
Hello, this is Free Will Matters. My name is Santiago Amaya, and I'm an associate professor in philosophy at Universidad de los Andes in Bogotá. I am the host of this podcast.
Hi, I'm Manuel Vargas, and I'm a professor of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego. I am also the host of this podcast.
The human ability to decide and act freely requires that we think of ourselves as agents of a particular kind. We must have the ability to form intentions, to deliberate, to exercise self-control, plan for the future, and so on. At the same time, we are creatures bound by the context and the circumstances that we occupy. What kind of agents, then, are we? How is our agency shaped by the world in which we live? For this season, our guests will be distinguished authors and researchers working on the philosophy of agency. The philosophy of agency can be a daunting endeavor, but with their help, we will get to know better the what, the how, and the why of our agency. Welcome.
For today's episode, our guest is Jennifer Morton. Jennifer is Presidential Penn Compact Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a senior fellow at the Center for Ethics and Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her book, Moving Up Without Losing Your Way, The Ethical Costs of Upward Mobility, has been awarded the Frederick W. Ness Book Award by the Association of American Colleges and Universities, and was selected as Princeton President Isaac Gruber's pre-read for the class of 2025. In addition to education, Jennifer has written about self-control, grit, and is interested in the multiple ways in which economic and social deprivation affects and shapes people's agency.
Welcome, Jen.
I'm happy to be here.
Okay, let us start with the first question. It is generally very easy to describe what many philosophers of agency do in very abstract terms. They're interested in defining what an action is or what characterizes an agent. But instead of proceeding this way, you start from a very concrete observation. Many people live under situations of economic deprivation. And you ask a question, what kind of agency do these people have? Can you tell us a little bit about this general approach? How did you get interested in it? How did you come to this more concrete way of thinking about agency?
What I noticed when I was working on the topic of my dissertation is that we were relying on all of these intuitions about how people reason. But in fact, there was a disconnect, I think, between the intuitions that one might have if one has grown up in a pretty comfortable middle-class family and the intuitions that one might have if one has been living under conditions of scarcity. This was very just like a thought that I had on the basis of my experience. But I was fortunate that a social psychologist that were working on this topic found empirical evidence that supported that kind of intuition, that there was a difference in how one engaged in little deliberation, but also how one approached one's goals if one is living under conditions of scarcity than if one is not. And so I thought that this was a kind of important topic to look into because philosophers of action and agency generally work in this way of thinking about these abstract examples in which we are just relying on our intuitions. And many times those intuitions come from our lived experiences and I think would be very different if we had different lived experiences.
One of the questions you ask about is what sorts of things we can learn from the moral psychology of agents by looking at how they behave in situations of poverty. And one of the important things for agency in general is self-control. What does self-control look like under conditions of scarcity?
It's interesting to think about this question of self-control with respect to the agency of people living under conditions of economic scarcity. So I actually think that self-control is not really what is at issue. I think there is a different but often related phenomenon, which has to do with short-term thinking. So the way that I think about this is that people under conditions of scarcity engage in a lot of short-term thinking instead of a lot of long-term thinking. And they do so because it's really important that they think about satisfying immediate needs and goals that they have, right? So if you're worried about putting food on the table, about finding shelter, about staying bodily integrity, you really need to prioritize thinking about those short-term ends in order to achieve them. And that is different than lacking self-control. So I think in the philosophical literature, we often kind of lump together short-term thinking and failures of self-control. And we do so because a lot of the examples that we use are the classic kind of like, you're on a diet and there's a cookie in front of you, right? And you're tempted to eat the cookie, but you have this long-term plan to lose weight and you think, I shouldn't eat the cookie. And this is the kind of question that a lot of philosophers of action have focused on. But I think that is a totally different phenomenon than the question faced by someone in conditions of economic scarcity who is thinking, you know, I need to pay rent tomorrow. I might have to take out a loan. Now, that loan in the long term might have terrible interest rates, might really kind of sink me deeper into poverty, but tomorrow I have to pay the rent. And so I might do something that seems very short-term focused, and I think it is short-term focused, at the expense of a long-term goal I might have to be in better economic conditions down the line. But that's not like giving into the temptation of the cookie, I think. And yet, I think we tend to lump these two things together. But I think it's a distinct kind of thinking in which we are prioritizing, deliberating about, and solving short-term problems. And that often comes at the expense of deliberating and thinking about solving kind of long-term goals that we might have.
In addition to writing about self-control, you've also written a little bit about grit, and we want to ask you about it as well. Can you tell us what grit is? What distinguishes grit from other similar capacities? And to what extent does grit interact with people's abilities to flourish under conditions of poverty?
So I became interested in grit through thinking about philosophy of education, because there is some interest among education researchers in thinking more about grit as an important capacity that we need to instill in children. Now, grit is the capacity to persevere in the pursuit of a long-term goal, even when you encounter challenges and setbacks that might derail you. So many of us are familiar and engage in gritty goals, right? So going to graduate school, you know, maybe if you're saving up to buy a home, even in cases in which, you know, you might have to persevere in order to just make it from day to day because you encounter all sorts of challenges and setbacks in your way. So grit has this kind of place in the philosophy of education because people have thought, you know, there's something about this capacity to persevere that's really important to achievement, and that we don't really pay sufficient attention to it in the educational context. Now, the work that I've done on grit has focused on the epistemic dimension. By that, I mean what beliefs one needs to have in order to persevere in the pursuit of a goal. So suppose I form the goal to go to graduate school in philosophy, and I encounter some setback or some challenge in that path. For example, I get a bad grade in a class or on a paper, or maybe I encounter some negative feedback. And that might be the kind of thing that undermines my confidence and makes me think I really shouldn't be thinking about going to graduate school in philosophy. The gritty person, on the other hand, would look at that kind of challenge and setback and say, well, I still think I can do this, even though, you know, I'm disappointed by the setback, and I'm going to persevere because I believe that I can still succeed. And it is that belief that my collaborator, Sarah Paul, and I think is really important to thinking about grit. With respect to how to think about grit under conditions of scarcity, I think that it's really critical that we think about whether we're putting people, and in particular children, when we're talking about grit in schools, in conditions where they can really sustain that kind of commitment to an end. So I think it's all too easy for us to say, you know, we should ensure and encourage children to have grit. That's what's going to lead them to go to college and have good lives and so on. But if we're not putting people in conditions in which they can sustain that commitment, then I think what we're doing is a disservice to the people whom we're kind of expecting to somehow magically persevere even when they're under really hard and difficult conditions.
Living under conditions of oppression often leads to what have been called pessimism traps. And one might think that to counter these traps, being optimistic might be a good remedy. But you disagree with this. Can you explain to us what these pessimism traps are, why we should think more about them, and why is optimism not a good practical remedy?
Sure. So the way that I think about pessimism traps is as a situation in which an agent has a good bit of evidence that a particular ambitious end that she wants to pursue is going to be very difficult for her, right? And this might not be because of the agent's abilities or skills or her, you know, willingness to work hard, but it can just be because of the kind of social context that she's in. So one example that we might use is, say you're a woman who's interested in mathematics and maybe pursuing graduate school in mathematics, and you look around you and see that there are very few women who are pursuing this path. You see that maybe there isn't a lot of support for women in mathematics. You think, you know, this is something I'm interested in, but it's going to be very difficult for me to succeed given the evidence at my disposal in light of my gender. And you can run the example thinking about other kinds of sources of oppression. Now, if you're in that situation, it might be the reasonable thing to do to set yourself some other goal that is a little bit less ambitious, but that perhaps is more feasible for you, right? So you might think, hey, you know, I'm also interested in, I don't know, becoming an accountant, and like doing accounting seems like I would, you know, get a good salary, get a good job. I see other women going into accounting. I have the math skills. And you think, I'm going to go that route instead of trying to pursue graduate education in mathematics. And so part of what you're responding to in that case is evidence about how hard it will be for you to pursue one ambitious end, and how much easier it might be for you to pursue something that's slightly less ambitious from your perspective. And the factor that seems to be making a difference is the social context, right? That historically, it's been very hard for women to enter the world of academia and mathematics, and maybe easier to say, become an accountant, and that seems to be playing a role. Of course, the problem with this is that if you run this argument and decide, okay, I'll go for accounting, there aren't going to be more women going into mathematics. And so the next woman that comes up behind you is going to face a similar situation, right? She's going to look at mathematics and think, I don't think that's a very friendly path for women like me. And so be dissuaded perhaps from pursuing it. And so you see how this can lead to a kind of trap where people who are under certain conditions of social oppression look at some fields or some ends or some paths ahead of them and see that it's very hard for people who are from their social class or their gender or their racial background and opt not to pursue it, and thus, you know, kind of making it even more likely that people behind them won't pursue that path, and you kind of get into this pessimism trap as I see it. So one thing that you might say when you're confronting this kind of pessimism trap is like, no, you shouldn't be dissuaded by that kind of evidence. You should believe in yourself. You can do it, right? And like lots of people hear that kind of advice. And I think that that isn't really a very good solution for many people. I think in some cases it's true. So I think if there is, you know, if a particular path is going to be difficult, but maybe the costs of failure are not very high for you, or maybe it's not really as difficult as you think. Maybe being optimistic is the kind of thing that will help you go forward. But I think in situations of real scarcity, right, where the costs of failure are high, I think to encourage people to be optimistic in those situations is really potentially encouraging them to pay a really heavy cost for failure. So here I'm thinking of what we might say to a student from low-income background who's going to a high school in which not a lot of students go to college, not a lot of students even graduate high school. We say, you should believe in yourself, like go to college. That's a way of being optimistic. But maybe in their experience, they've seen a few people from their neighborhood or their school try, end up in debt, end up having failed out of school. And they see this as a very risky bet. And I think they're right if they have that kind of evidence that it is a risky bet, right? And that it might be that they end up failing and then having a mountain of debt in front of them. So I think optimism isn't the right remedy. Remedies you might think are better are things like making it easier for people to fail. So maybe we don't encourage a student like that to take on a lot of debt to go to college, right? Because then if they were to take on this ambitious and then fail, they weren't paying a really big cost for that failure. So I think that that's a better way of thinking about how to help someone in that situation rather than just encouraging them to be optimistic.
So Jen, one main thread running through your recent work concerns the detrimental effects that middle-class education and labor markets can have on members of minority groups. Can you give us an example of these effects? Can you tell us a little bit about why they happen? And what do you recommend for individuals and institutions hoping to avoid these kinds of problems?
Yeah, great. So for a long time, I taught at the City College of New York in the CUNY system. And a lot of my students there were first-generation low-income students. And what I saw with many of my students was that they were often torn between and playing critical roles that they played for their families, like working many hours to contribute financially or providing childcare or providing other sorts of care for people in their families or their friends groups or their communities, and pursuing higher education. And many of my students were very committed to getting their degree and to having a better lives than that of their parents, economically at least. But they also wanted to be there for their families and their communities and their friends and to provide the kind of care that they thought their loved ones needed. And there was a tension that I saw with many of my students, and some of them who ended up resolving that tension by putting their own educational ambitions ahead of those other obligations they had to their communities, ended up feeling like they had given up on something important. And that's what I call my book, The Ethical Cost of Upward Mobility. I think that this phenomenon is ethical insofar as we are asking of students in low-income communities, students who are first-generation college students, to give up an important aspect of their lives that has value and meaning in order to access certain educational and career opportunities, certain economic opportunities. And I think that this way that we have of structuring higher education and really economic opportunities in the labor market can undermine important social goods. So I think it should lead us to think more carefully about what sorts of values we end up promoting when we structure higher education in such a way that a person who wants to succeed, wants to do well, wants to go to college and get a good job is in the position of feeling like they're letting their community down or they're letting their friends down or their family down and can't be there in the way that they want to be there.
Philosophers sometimes talk about poverty. What's the most pervasive mistake that you think they make when they do talk about poverty?
So I actually think the biggest mistake that philosophers make when they talk about poverty is that they don't really talk about it. I mean, some philosophers do, right? So people interested in inequality and distribution will talk about poverty in a fairly abstract way, as in, you know, there are people who are the least well off in our society, and we want to think about what the right way is to respond to that fact. But we don't really try to think about what is the perspective of someone living in that situation? Like, how do they inhabit the world? How do they move through it? We just assume, I think often, that they're just like us. They just have fewer resources. But I don't think that can be right. I think that if any of us were in a situation in which we were growing up in serious deprivation and scarcity, that would change how we moved in the world, what we thought, what we wanted. And so I don't think philosophers have really thought hard about what it means to be a member of a social class and how that really changes our agency in pretty deep and fundamental ways.
So one last question. Can you tell us what are, in your opinion, the most interesting topics and questions that philosophers of agency are discussing now and will be discussing intensively over the next few years?
So I think an important bit of philosophy of action is going to come out of thinking about these beliefs involved in agency. I also think that philosophers are thinking more about how oppression, race, gender, and social class affect how we exist in the world. And what's interesting about this is that, of course, social scientists have been thinking about this for a very long time, but many of us philosophers have been sort of talking about similar domains of human experience, but without really reading and engaging with the social science or psychology or cognitive psychology on these sorts of topics. And so I think that we will see more philosophers of action really engaging with the empirical literature and thinking more about how our agency is embedded in a particular social context on the basis of our position in society. And our position in society is very dependent on these social categories like race and gender and social class. And so I think there will be a lot more interdisciplinary work in this area, or I hope there will be.
Well, thank you so much. That was great, Jen.
Thanks.
Free Will Matters is part of the LATAM Free Will Agency and Responsibility Project. It is produced by 070, thanks to a generous grant of the John Templeton Foundation, and with the support of Universidad de los Andes and the University of California in San Diego. For more information, visit us at freewill.uniandes.edu.co. That is freewill.uniandes.edu.co.